Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how the two Republican frontrunners will do in a matchup with President Obama. Alan Lichtman, the distinguished professor of history at American University, joins us. He is the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way of Predicting the Next President, a system that has correctly predicted all U.S. presidential outcomes since 1984. Then we will look into the intense religiosity of Rick Santorum that pundits argue cost him the election in Michigan and make him unelectable in a general election. Meanwhile, at the state level, much of Santorum's extreme positions on social issues are being voted into law in legislatures in Virginia, Alabama, and Oklahoma, and will be voted on tomorrow in the United States Senate. Sarah Posner, senior editor at Religion Dispatches and author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values, joins us. Then finally, we'll look into the new nukes for food deal with North Korea with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus. He was a Pantech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University and taught at Sungkyunkwo University in Seoul, South Korea, and is the author of North Korea, South Korea, U.S. Policy at a Time of Crisis. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studies both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And after the last night's primaries in Arizona and Michigan, with Romney narrowly winning in Michigan and soundly winning in Arizona, what's your predictions in terms of a Romney versus Obama race, if that's to be?
Well, I first issued my prediction for the general election of 2012 in January 2010. Nearly 3 years before the election. And as early as that, it was pretty clear to me that the keys to the White House were lining up in favor of the incumbent Democratic Party. There are 13 keys. They are simple true-false questions that look at the state of the country and the strength of the party holding the White House, basically saying the White House is won or lost by what the party in power does, and there's little the opposition can do to change the verdict. It looks at things like third parties, whether the sitting president is running, whether there's a contest for the incumbent party nomination, policy change, social unrest, scandal, foreign policy successes and failures, and of course the long and the short-term economy. And it takes six of these factors to count out the party in power. In January of 2010, I had four down against the party holding the White House. Now I only have three down. In other words, remarkably, prospects have gotten a little bit better for the party in power, mainly because Barack Obama has had some very splashy successes in foreign affairs, eliminating bin Laden, eliminating Gaddafi, liberating Libya, while at the same time he hasn't had any big setbacks, no scandals, no major social unrest. Of course, there's been the Occupy movement, the Tea Party, but nothing like millions of people out in the streets in the 1960s, the city burning. And of course, it's now clear there's no opposition to him, and that certainly doesn't look like there's a major Ross Perot-type third party on the horizon. So even with the sour economy, which certainly counts against him, the kinds of circumstances that favor the party in power now stand in favor of the incumbent Democrats, whether it's Romney or anyone else.
Well, of course, in the Michigan primary, Santorum encouraged Democrats to cross over in the open primary and vote for him. And the assumption is that a lot of Democrats feel that Santorum is easier to beat than Romney. But in many ways, they represent the sort of heart and the head of the Republican Party. And it would seem that just as Santorum may well have sabotaged himself by dissing JFK and bringing up contraception and homeschooling and the idea that going to college is some kind of a form of elitism, all of this crazy stuff apparently played well. But the more that one sees Romney in comparison to Santorum, the more I think it's a stark choice for the Republicans between the passions of the right and this kind of corporatist CEO whose speech last night was like listening to a corporate presentation. And frankly, if he is to become president, he'll be the CEO and his press secretary will report to the American people. He doesn't do press conferences, you know. He doesn't do the Sunday talk shows, this guy.
Well, you know, Romney is famous for saying corporations are people, and he lives that. He is the living, breathing embodiment of the soulless, passionless, inspirationalist, if that's a word, corporation. You know, nobody but nobody, including, you know, loyal Republicans, are willing to walk through a brick wall for Mitt Romney. There are those who think he's okay. There are those who think, you know, because he's so bland that he might give Barack Obama more of a challenge than someone who's kind of on the acid side of the right. And, you know, all of that may be correct, but this guy will absolutely be a cog in the corporate machine once he becomes elected. Of course, I don't think that's going to happen. But let me make it clear, though. When it comes to economic policy, they're all peas in the same pod. They all are against regulation. They all want deregulation. They all want to kill off the EPA. They all want to balloon the deficit by cutting taxes, which are going to mostly benefit the corporations and the wealthy. They're no different when it comes to the policy that benefit the rich and benefit the corporations. You know, conservatives talk a good game about being for limited government and fiscal responsibility and free markets. They're nothing of the kind. There's no fiscal responsibility in their programs. They are going to profligately increase the deficit. Remember, the big deficit increasers were the two most conservative presidents since World War II, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. So there's no fiscal responsibility. There's no limited government. I mean, to do what they want to do, to, you know, toss out the supposedly undocumented immigrants, to police, you know, every time a woman wants to have a reproductive decision, they're going to have an army of police and federal bureaucrats to do that. To promote their foreign policy, their, you know, war against drugs, they're going to have an army of police forces. It's not about big government versus small government. They're only against big government when it comes to regulating the abuses of business or providing social welfare. They're all for big government when it comes to providing corporate welfare, all these special tax breaks and export guarantees to the big corporations, when it comes to police and military forces.
Well, obviously, it would be good, I think, to have a referendum on the religious right if Santorum were to be the candidate. That way you would be able to sort of test the limits of the America's theocratic constituency. And on the other hand, it might be useful to have a corporatist to see how bringing into stark relief the 99% versus the 1%. It's difficult to know in terms of choosing your poison, which would be the most salutary lesson for the American electorate, or conversely, which would be the most dangerous if one of them got elected.
Both dangerous, and I'm not sure they're that different. You know, maybe you don't believe what Mitt Romney says, but on the social issues, with the exception of contraception, but on abortion, on immigration, on gay marriage rights, he is as far to the right as Rick Santorum, at least in terms of what he is saying now. He is trying to portray himself as, you know, an epitomal, social, right-wing conservative. If you read my book, I talk in my book about the fact that the core values of conservatism are the social conservatism, what they consider to be white Christian values, and economic conservatism, not free markets. I mean, my God, for most of this 20th century, they were for protective tariffs, and they're still for all kinds of corporate protections and corporate welfare, but private enterprise. And at least in terms of what they are saying, they're both saying the same things about both of those sides of the conservative coin. Again, you may not believe that Mitt Romney has his heart in it when it comes to the social issues. We know he has his heart, soul, and pocketbook in it when it comes to conservative economic issues. But nonetheless, the Republican Party as a whole has moved so far to the right that the price of admission is to be an extremist on the social issue, just to get in the door.
Well, the thing that the difference from my point of view, and perhaps it's just coming at it from a journalistic point of view, is that I find that Santorum is a more accessible, open candidate. He's so open to the point where he can't stop his own theocratic impulses, and he may well have stepped in it by particularly saying some of the more outrageous things about how JFK makes him throw up, which doesn't go down well with Catholic voters.
Go after our one Catholic president and you're a Catholic candidate.
Right.
But you're right. It's because he is not scripted.
Right.
He's not a plastic man like Mitt Romney. He's a real person. You may not like the person that he is, but he is a real person who actually says, at least up to now, what he believes. You know, once the consultants and the ad men and the hucksters, you know, remold him, he may become more plastic and less accessible, you know, given the fact that his open mouth so far has done nothing but attract flies.
Well, but the other guy, though, conversely, is not just scripted. He reads from the teleprompter. He doesn't make impromptu speeches. Whenever he says anything impromptu, it's usually a gaffe, like his wife having two Cadillacs and how only he doesn't know anything about NASCARs, and he's not a fan, but he does have friends who own NASCAR teams.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But what I find really offensive and would be chilling, I think, to have a president like this is the extent to which he will not expose himself to the press, to have press conferences, and to even go on the Sunday shows. He goes on Fox, and that's it.
And who knows today who is the CEO of Exxon? Who can tell you? You know, the biggest, most powerful corporation. No one knows who that CEO is. That CEO does not expose himself to the press, does not say things candidly and openly. And you're going to have the president in the mode of the CEO of Exxon, if in fact Mitt Romney is the president. And, you know, the open question about Mitt Romney, too, is what does he really believe? It is impossible to tell because he has, you know, shifted his position so many times and seems willing to say whatever is necessary to get elected. I don't understand why the guy wants to be president. Usually you want to be president because you have some kind of convictions. I'm not sure he has any convictions other than, you know, I really want to be president as kind of a capstone of my career. It's not clear I want to be president because I fervently believe in certain things and want to implement them as, you know, the commander-in-chief and head of the executive branch of the American government.
Well, as I say, he comes across when he was talking last night, where he spends all his time, you know, just sort of penny-ante attacks on Obama, reflexive, but very hollow, sort of
stuff,
false,
right.
False anger and phony passion. But it all feels like a guy making an IPO, you know, initial public offering pitch to a bunch of Wall Street investment bankers, you know.
I agree with that, and, you know, that's why it's strange why he wants to be president, other than, you know, kind of the capstone of his career. You know, he's been a CEO, now he wants to be the biggest CEO.
Let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. And this battle, of course, is over for the presidency. It's all about winning the American right. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. And this system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. That on the one hand, you can make the argument that Santorum is, you know, his runaway mouth because he so passionately believes in homeschooling and, you know, American madrasas, if you will, and women should not have access to birth control, et cetera, and showing off his six kids at every opportunity, et cetera. As much as you can suggest that maybe it's not going to play to a national audience, and that's what all the pundits say, that, you know, it may work for the right-wing Christian right constituency of the Republican primary voters, but it's not going to work in a general election. Meanwhile, how do you explain how the same constituency that Santorum represents is having so many electoral successes at the state level? Look what's just happened in Virginia. Look what's happening in Alabama with all these personhood and these invasive procedures on women, basically forcing them, trying to guilt them into not having an abortion by unnecessary medical measures that are both expensive and completely counterindicated.
Yeah, no, this message is very powerful, but I think it is powerful not with the majority, but with a very passionate minority who, of course, tends to be overrepresented in the South, which is why you see so many of these measures in places like Virginia and Alabama. You don't see them in Illinois or New York or California or other places. But, you know, this idea of who is electable and who isn't is a lot of nonsense. You don't know who's electable. You don't know who can win and or who can't win. And my system, which, as you noted, has been right for seven elections in a row, says it really doesn't matter who the challenging party nominates. That's just one out of 13 keys. What really matters to the American people is how well the party in power has governed. And this idea of electability is sheer nonsense. Look at the Democrats in 2004. John Kerry was there, Mitt Romney. Nobody loved John Kerry. He wasn't exciting any passions. No one was willing to swim the Atlantic Ocean for him. Howard Dean was the guy who inspired passion. But the electorate went with John Kerry because they thought he was electable. And, of course, not only did he lose, but he is roundly condemned today for running a miserable campaign. I don't think that's true. If you look at it, he won all three debates, for example. But he still lost because the state of the country in 2004 was not quite yet bad enough for the American people to reject the party in power. So I always tell everyone, whether you're on the right or the left, throw out the whole notion of electability. If I had to abolish any given word from the language, it would be electability. And vote for who you believe in. If you believe in the corporatism of Mitt Romney, by all means, vote for Mitt Romney. If you believe in the theocratic approach of Rick Santorum, by all means, vote for Rick Santorum. But you're leading yourself down the primrose path if you believe you can judge who's electable and who isn't.
Well, of course, that's not going to stop the press from their honing in on this process, this electoral process, which here we are both guilty of following it. And indeed, we are about to, in a week's time, have Super Tuesday, which, of course, is going to be incredibly hyped up. And there appears to be a real possibility of a fairly long and bruising battle all the way to Tampa, Republican convention, with 437 electoral votes up for grab. A lot of these states that are being contested next Tuesday, Tennessee, Georgia, Virginia, Oklahoma, they're pretty much Bible Belt states, aren't they? You're gonna have Gingrich hoping for some kind of resurrection, and Santorum basically saying now it's a two-man race. It's possible that Romney's not going to do well on Super Tuesday, isn't it?
It's very possible. As you say, Gingrich could appeal to the Bible Belt, although, you know, social conservative voters never seem to care about your personal morality. It doesn't matter if you're a philanderer, if you treated women miserably, so long as you say the right things, it seems to appeal to them. Look at Senator David Vitter is still in office, still winning handily, even though, you know, he has been fairly well established to be patronizing prostitutes, and yet he's still a family value candidate. So they don't seem to care how you live your life. They only seem to care what you say. And Gingrich could do well. Santorum could do very well in Ohio, which is, you know, next door to Pennsylvania. And this could be a long, bruising battle, but it doesn't matter. Everyone talks about, oh, you know, all the Republicans are wringing their hair about the long, bruising battle. The longest and most bruising battle in the history of the Republican Party was 1952, when the moderate, similar to this, although different issues, the moderate Dwight Eisenhower was up against the champion of the conservatives, Senator Robert Taft. Not only did they fight throughout the primary season, and there weren't as many primaries then, a lot of delegates were chosen by party bosses, but that battle went right down to the convention and was only decided in Eisenhower's favor when he won a credentials battle over the delegates from Texas. And the conservatives were furious. They called it the Texas Steal. Taft was so furious it took quite some time for him to endorse Eisenhower. And that rankled for conservatives for decades. And guess what? Eisenhower won that election in a near landslide.
Well, but that's often cited, I think, erroneously by people who keep saying, oh, there's going to be some, you know, man on a white horse is going to rescue the Republican ticket from its fratricide.
That is very erroneous.
Because that's
Eisenhower fought the whole way.
Right.
And new person came in.
Right. But Eisenhower, I mean, Taft actually had more votes, delegates going in, didn't he?
That's right. It was only when Eisenhower, because the Texas delegation was actually awarded to Taft by the Taft Majority Central Committee of Texas, even though Eisenhower won the caucuses, and that decision was reversed. But no one came in to that convention. That never happens.
Right, but it's so pervasive that people think that somebody can be anointed as opposed to earning it the old-fashioned way, which is getting the actual votes. The idea that
never happened in modern history.
Exactly.
The only example, really, of that is someone who, you know, came in late was Hubert Humphrey, who came in very late. But that was a very special circumstance, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, who looked like he was heading to be the nominee after he won California. And, of course, Hubert Humphrey lost. Adlai Stevenson in 52 didn't contest the primaries. You go back to that election, and he lost handily. There's no example in modern history of a convention going down, you know, to the wire in the modern era of primary battles, deciding the election, and someone who hasn't been tested at all coming in and saving the party. No modern day example of that. In fact, Republicans ought to be chastened by the fact that if someone comes in, they haven't been, as you say, tested and scrutinized. And look what happened to candidates like Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Herman Cain, who at first blush, you know, looked terrific. You know, they swept a lot of the electorate. And then, lo and behold, they couldn't withstand the scrutiny. Are you going to try that with a brand new nominee who hasn't had the scrutiny that only comes with a presidential campaign and risk having that scrutiny not come in the primary process when you can flush them out, but in the general election when you're stuck with them?
Well, Alan Lichtman, I guess if we didn't do anything else today, at least we clarified that ridiculous canard that's floating around that somebody, Jeb Bush, is going to come in at the last minute and rescue the Republicans. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He studies both the American right and the presidency, and his books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Republican War on Women.